Okay, it's 9 o'clock, and people are still going to be coming on, but we have to get going, especially since I received many emails to comment and clarify things. So let's take, as always, 10 minutes to do that. Hopefully, I'll get to all of them. Some of you were interested in this concept I spoke about of Tav L'Meitav Tandu and this dispute between Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Rachman. I can send anyone, if you email me, a little article that Rabbi Rachman wrote in which Rabbi Soloveitchik said to him that he looks at halacha historically, whereas that is, Rachman looks at halacha historically, and Rabbi Soloveitchik looks at it at meta-historically. But this notion of Tav L'Meitav Tandu, meaning that a woman would really basically be married to anyone than be single, which would then mean that you can't revoke a marriage, annul a marriage after the fact. And there are some poskim who take that, as I said, very far, even an impotent husband, although many poskim say it doesn't go that far. Rav Soloveitchik never spoke practically, halachically, but he spoke about, it's an existential fact, he says. This is not due to the inferior status of the woman, but to the basic distinction between the female and the male personality. He says that this is a chazakah of the sages, based on permanent ontological principles rooted in the very depths of the metaphysical human personality, meaning that a woman, by definition, wants to be married, even if the husband is pretty bad, much of a bad guy. And therefore, we can't assume that the upshot of this, what the whole this chazakah is used in all the sources, you can't then say, well, had she known X or Y, she wouldn't have agreed to marry him. Now, the problem with this is, and I'm going to do it in more detail when we do our classes on Rabbi Rachman, is that, first of all, and you can look in the Encyclopedia Talmudica about this, you'll see that none of the early tshuvot that discussed this matter refer to this as a chazakah. They see it as sort of a description, but not a halachic chazakah. And even if it is a chazakah, as we mentioned already last time, most chazakahs change. Now, for some reason, they change with the reality. For some reason, in certain modern Orthodox circles, this has become a basic concept. In fact, this is was stated by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his famous lecture, in which he spoke about denying the sages, heresy, anyone who denies this. The problem is, well, other than the fact that no one else in history has ever seemed to say that, if you look at Igros Moshe, Evan Ezra, Volume 4, Number 83, and like I said, when we deal with Rabbi Rachman, we'll go into more detail, because Rachman saw himself as following Rav Moshe. This is on page 151. Rav Moshe says about this concept, Tav L'Meitav Tandu, that a woman would rather be married, no matter what her circumstances are. He's saying that this is not a halach matter or a matter of musar. It's just an understanding. And then he goes further. And he says, Bizmanenu bavanos harabim. Sharbei nashim einan shomros dinei haTorah. Umachalo shavos v'frehesia. Ve'elo hanashim eini baishu gam biznus ein lamar bahu tav l'meitav tandu. Rav Moshe says that on the contrary, this isn't an essential aspect to women. And he says, if anything, can only be applied to religious women, but in that, the women who are not religious, or Chol Shabbos, etc., he says explicitly, by them, Ein Lomar Tav L'Meitav Tandu. So where's Rabbi Soloveitchik? And I said, all these modern Orthodox types, they make it into such a big deal that this is basic. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, it's ontological. Rav Moshe Feinstein explicitly says, it's not ontological. It's not ontological at all. At best, it characterizes religious Jewish women, but it doesn't characterize femininity. It's not an ontological principle. And we'll see when I go into this. There's many more. It's Rav Soloveitchik that's a chiddush. Everyone else assumes just the opposite. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, although he never dealt with Rachman's claim of how far you can go to annul marriages, I think Rachman's correct that the whole basis for Rav Moshe, what Rav Moshe's doing is a rejection of Rav Soloveitchik. And you can't get any clearer than what he says right here, that it doesn't apply. It only applies to certain women for religious reasons, because they have a certain religious conception of marriage, etc. A trick in the rabbi's bag of tricks. I'm not sure what you mean by that, but okay. I mentioned last class that Rav Meir Simcha, after the San Remo conference, he said that there's no more, this is in response to Yisrael Kashkin's question, there's no more issue of the shvuot, the so-called oaths binding Jews. from not going up to the land of Israel. This, someone asked what the San Remo conference is. Well, you can easily find it online. That was a conference that took place in 1920 that distributed the land for the various mandates. Then Lebanon, Syria were given to the French. Palestine was given to the English. And since then, we all know there was a Balfour Declaration. A few years before that, when Rameir Simcha saw that the British were given this, and they had already declared that they viewed with favor the establishment of a Jewish homeland in the land of in Palestine, therefore there's no longer an issue of the so-called oaths, the shvuot. And that led to a question about Agudas Yisrael's position. So I'm asked these questions, and I speak from memory, and I might not be exact, but I was exact this time. Fortunately, I went back. Anyone who wants to check it up can see it's in Hapardes, year 11, Overit, that is issue 7, beginning on page 8, and they have the whole discussion there, really almost the transcript, an abridged transcript of the Agudas Yisrael 1937 convention in Marienbad. And you see there Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Yochanan Wasserman, like I mentioned, the extremists who wanted to come out opposed to the state of Israel, a future state of Israel, joined by Yaakov Rosenheim of the German Aguda. And then you have the Nasi, the president of the convention, Yehuda Leib Tzurlson, very much against this. And also the masses. I mean, you have to be an Agudist in Germany to actually be opposed to a state, because I'm talking about if you're one of the laity as opposed to the rabbis, because if you're a typical Jew in Poland or Lithuania, your Jewish soul tells you that it's a great thing to have a state. And Rav Tzurlson spoke very strongly about it, and the majority agreed against Rav Yochanan and Rav Aaron Cutler that we have to support the establishment of the State of Israel. And this is the words, Asur lidchot behechlet dvar medina hayehudit. It's forbidden for us to reject the establishment of the state. Rather, we must work inside, that is, the movement, to try to make it follow Torah principles. And the official statement is found in the previous issue, Choveret Vav, in which they speak about that there's a chus from the people of Israel to have a homeland in the land of Israel, but we have to insist that it follows Torah law, whereas Rav Yochanan Wasserman and others thought that once you have a state, it's immediately going to be anti-Torah. Rav Tzurlson and the majority of the Aguda thought that this is not true, and that we can work, and it turns out, of course, they were right, that the State of Israel has been the biggest boon for Torah study in the land of Israel. So I was correct when I said that Aguda never officially opposed the State of Israel. Let's see, a couple more minutes here. About the Brisker Derech, I wanted to call your attention to this. Also on HebrewBooks.org, the Sefer Yovel of Rav Shimon Shkup. You look on page 20, you see Rabbi Unterman actually precedes Rabbi Soloveitchik in saying that, in speaking about how the method of Rav Chaim was actually a good defense against the rising Haskalah. Okay, one more thing. Someone said it wasn't clear, so I'm going to say this again. I'll just say it in 30 seconds about the idea of the Birkat HaMinim that I spoke about. Basically, we have a prayer. It's called Birkat HaMinim, prayer against the heretics. We say it three times a day. However, if you look at the prayer book, take a look in the English, or if you don't know Hebrew, there is nothing in this prayer against the Minim, against the heretics. So everyone should wonder, why is a prayer that has nothing against the heretics called the prayer against the heretics? Now, if you look at the Yemenite prayer book, if you look at the Rambam's prayer book, if you look at every single manuscript, you will see that it says nothing about the slanderers, the malshinim. It speaks about the minim. And what the min was always understood to be referred to Judeo-Christians. So the censors were responsible for that. Either the Jews anticipating the censors or the censors themselves got rid of this from the printed prayer books. But that's not the authentic text. And we continue to daven with the false text. And then I pointed out that Art Scroll doesn't know this. And therefore, they claim that this prayer is directed against certain slanderers, which, as I said, it never was. Among them, the Essenes, as if the Essenes living in the middle of nowhere were slandering, and the Judeo-Christians and the Sadducees. By the way, no one ever, as I said, thought that these were minim. Not the Sadducees or the Essenes. Until Art Scroll, no one in history ever suggested that these could be identified in this prayer, and certainly not with slandering. Who are the meaning, though? There's a dispute. Many think it is the Judeo-Christians. Others think it's certain dualistic sects, or maybe just the Romans. But as I mentioned, there's nothing at all to do with Essenes or Sadducees or anything like that. I see. I have 9:09, so I'll just make one more. Actually, no, I'll save it for next class. I have some other interesting stuff. Okay. I mentioned that last class, Yisrael, but the question was, why was he opposed to the state? And I said he was opposed to the state, not because he was opposed to the idea of Jews having a state, but he thought that it would lead to bloodshed. And therefore, he didn't feel that he could support a state. If you were, think back to the time, the Arab armies were ready, were massing on the border, and as soon as the state would be declared, they were going to invade. And he didn't think it was worth it, and he was a pessimist. He thought that the state would not be able to survive, and that Jews should look to the West, to America. But it wasn't a theological opposition. And as soon as the state was declared, he becomes the biggest supporter, much more of a supporter than the Aguda. Remember, the Aguda, as far as they were concerned, the state was really just a way to get money. They never identified with the state per se, unlike Repenkin. Okay, I want to go back, review one thing before we go further. And a number of you asked me about this. Here's the passage I spoke about. I think I read it correctly, but it's possible to read it slightly differently. Here's the passage, what it says, Kol Yachid, he's saying that everyone should pick a place to daven, where the people are religious. And if there's no place such as this, the synagogue, for example, has non-religious Jews, but it's a kosher synagogue, you could still go there. That is a synagogue where people are Mechal Shabbos. Then he says, and follow along in the Hebrew with me, those who know Hebrew. If the place itself is questionable, because there are men sitting together with women, the halacha is that it's better to daven by yourself. So Rav Henkin acknowledges that if you're in a place and the only synagogue there is a mixed seating synagogue, you should daven by yourself. Then he says, "Din ein makom klal," if there's no other place, and you'd have to daven always by yourself. You need to examine, how problematic this is going to be. And then he goes on and says, and you have to look on the opposing side, maybe that if you involve yourself, not just you, other people, in the synagogue, you could protest and you could... you could help fix it. Atikva al-Atikun, that means you can, if religious Jews, that is, Jews who believe in Mechitza start davening there, they could perhaps be an influence on fixing the shul, making it have Mechitza. And then he says, nevertheless, if you do go there, though, you need to protest and let the people know that they need to put a Mechitza in. Now, it's possible to read it differently than I read it. It's possible to read this as saying that... if the only shul is one without a mechitza, then you have to examine what's worse. On the one hand, you davening by yourself is one thing, but if you daven by yourself, then you don't have an opportunity to influence the people. I didn't read it that way. I thought that Rav Henkin here was speaking of two separate things here. One being the problem that if you daven by yourself, you won't have any communal Jewish life. And then there's a second thing, that you have an opportunity to influence them. Because the reason I say this is because if the whole point is that you have to take, the scale of values, on the one hand, you can avoid the shul without the mechitza, on the other hand, you can go there and try to influence them, then what does it matter if it's the only shul in town? Let's say there's two shuls in town, one that has a mechitza and one that doesn't have a mechitza. If the whole point is to do kiruv, then even if you have a shul with a mechitza, you still should say, you should go to the other shul sometimes. The fact that he says you're in a place where it doesn't have any other shul, and you have to daven b'yachidus by yourself all the time, and you have to weigh it, that's why I think it's obvious there's two issues you have to weigh. One, your personal issue, that if you daven without a minyan continuously, that's going to affect your own Judaism. And then he says, And also, he throws in the fact that when you do daven in the other synagogue, you can influence them to perhaps put in a mechitza. That, I don't think there's any doubt that's how you have to read it. Mechitza, separate seating. It's a good question. I think the answer is, first of all, separate seating. Obviously, the best thing is to have a mechitza. But if the only thing you could do is get them to seat separately, Rav Henkin would say, do that. But the ultimate, the ideal, is a mechitza. Now, everyone always quotes Rabbi Soloveitchik as saying that it's forbidden to attend a mixed seating shul. Not a shul that's separate seating without a mechitza, as David mentions here. Rav didn't speak about that. However, attending a shul that's mixed seating, he went so far as to say that if you're going to miss Tekiyas HaShofar on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah, you shouldn't go there. The matters are really more complicated when it comes to the Rav. I mentioned last class, first of all, he was never speaking about non-Orthodox Jews. He was speaking about Orthodox Jews. But still, matters are more complicated. We know, first of all, that YU sent out many rabbis to mixed seating congregations as they saw it as a form of kiruv, and the Rav was part of that. That's the first thing. But I want to read to you now something that Rav Herschel Schechter published in the YU annual, as the annual for Reitz, Beis Yitzchak, a couple years ago. He's done this every year. He has something about Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he says he heard this from a Rabbi Zerubbabel Shusheim. I don't know who that is. Now, when he was a young student learning for smicha, that is, before they received smicha, they would go sometimes to serve as rabbis, quasi-rabbis, to make money on the various holidays. And there were some people that... So he went to the Rav, actually, and he wanted the Rav to help him get a position for the high holidays. And Rabbi Soloveitchik asked him, does he want to be in an Orthodox synagogue or a conservative synagogue? And when he says conservative synagogue, I think he might just mean here a synagogue without a mechitza. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says that to him, and this is Rav Schechter quoting, that you know that you can make more money in a conservative synagogue. So Rabbi Shusheim asked him, Rebbe, is it permitted to daven in a conservative synagogue where everyone is sitting together? Now, that's what a conservative synagogue means. In those days, remember, they didn't have conservative prayer books. I'm assuming it's a time when they didn't have it. Even when they had the conservative prayer book, they basically only got rid of one little thing in the Shemone Esrei, but you had plenty of so-called Orthodox shuls that were mixed seating. So he asked Rabbi Soloveitchik this. And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, "Lefi dati, in my opinion," and he says, and I'm saying this with all understanding of the consequences, someone who davens in a shul where men and women sit together, it's as if you're davening in a church. That's what Rabbi Soloveitchik says, and he often would repeat this. It's ironic because historically it's not true at all. The first mixed seating congregation in Jewish history was Isaac Meir Weiss's synagogue in Albany. In Germany, there were no, even the Reform did not have mixed seating congregations, and the churches didn't have mixed seating congregations either. So there's no history here, there's no tradition of Christians, of Catholics or Protestants sitting together. You know, this only came later in either the late 19th century, early 20th century that the churches started sitting together. It's more of an American thing. The family that prays together stays together, not a church thing. And I don't think Isaac Meir Weiss, I mean, you don't need the church for him to have decided that. But in any event, Rabbi Soloveitchik sees this as an example of Christianization of the synagogue. And then he says, I know, however, that there are many rabbis, Talmidei Chachamim, who don't agree with me about this. And Rav Schechter puts in parentheses, because in those days there were many synagogues which took down the mechitzas and had mixed seating davening. The rabbaneim shahayu talmidei chachamim meyeropa lo azvu et, you know, they didn't leave their positions. Now I don't really know if the Rav himself how much he disagrees with that, because when it comes to, remember, he was being asked this question by someone who wasn't really a rabbi, he wasn't going to influence, was just going to make some money. But Rabbi Soloveitchik himself agreed to have rabbis who were going to go work there, even for a limited time, but who were intent on putting in mechitzas to work there, as opposed to just going there for a weekend to make some money. I guess you say maybe these rabbis from Europe, including big Talmidei Chachamim, once the mechitzas were taken down, they just stayed there thinking, what can you do? Nebuch. And so Rabbi Soloveitchik says to him, therefore I say to you, if you want to rely on those people who are lenient, I will help you find a position that doesn't have a mechitza. And if you want to agree with my position, rely on my position, I will help you find an Orthodox shul. And then Rav Shechter in a note here says that it's well known the position of the Shar HaMelech, that if someone else, another posek, holds by the lenient opinions and I hold by the strict opinions, there's no prohibition on me, Rabbi X, allowing this person to follow the lenient opinions. So here you have Rav Shechter quoting the Rav as saying that although he feels strongly about this prohibition, since he knows that other people don't feel so strongly, it's really rhetoric in a sense. That's his position, but he's not declaring that everyone needs to follow it. And there's no element here even that this just refers to rabbis. He's simply saying other people don't think it's so terrible. And basically, we just saw Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin's position is that obviously this isn't what you should have. And Rav Henkin even says that if you look back at it, the rabbis have ruled that it's better to daven by Yechidus. But if that's too hard for you, you have to investigate it. So Rav Soloveitchik is acknowledging that other people did not hold his strong position and thought that it was okay under certain circumstances to go to a synagogue. And I will tell you that Rav Shechter himself holds this. There is a rabbi at YU. His name is Rabbi Daniel Fellman. He is maybe the greatest of all the Bekiyim after Rav Shechter in terms of wide-ranging knowledge. If you look at his books, they're full of incredible yedios. He will be a Rosh Hashiva one day at YU. I don't know if he officially has a title of Rosh Hashiva yet. But his father is Rabbi David Feldman from Teaneck, the Teaneck Jewish Center, a very great scholar. He wrote that book, Birth Control and Jewish Law, which if you'd read it, you'd have no idea that it wasn't written by an Orthodox Rav. He has Orthodox smicha as well as conservative. And he made a choice, unfortunate choice for him, and also for the Orthodox world, about 40 years ago to take a conservative pulpit. And that really puzzled him in the Orthodox world, because it turns out that the conservative movement moved very much to the left, and they never cared about David Feldman. He argued against counting women in minyan. He was really on the right wing. He was an enormous Talmud Chacham. And the Orthodox world, of course, couldn't care about him then, because he was in the conservative movement. But when he made this choice, it looked like the future was conservative Judaism. He, like many of the conservative rabbis, raised his children to be from Jews. Daniel Feldman becomes a huge Talmud Chacham. And Rav Shechter told Rabbi Daniel Feldman, remember, in Feldman Shul, it wasn't egalitarian. It still isn't egalitarian. The only difference is that there was mixed seating, but there was no, the sitter was a regular sitter, there was no egalitarianism. He told Rabbi Daniel Feldman that he could daven in his father's shul if just find a place on the side when there's no women around. And for Kibbutz Av, he could do that. Now the Jewish Center in Teaneck has an Orthodox minion in the shul as well, and eventually I guess that'll probably take over. So Rav Shechter himself followed that ruling that at times there's other circumstances that could come in and come to play here. So let me see what you have. There were some, David, some shuls that had separate seating without machitas. Most eventually went to completely mixed seating, but there were some. In fact, the JTS minion in the Unterberg Auditorium, which was the main minion for Shabbos, was separate seating without a machitza. But there were some synagogues that had that, 100%. Ah, there you go. Thank you, Larry. Yeah, that was called the Unterberg Auditorium. Incidentally, Rav Shechter goes on with some other interesting things here that to show you this concept that a Rav could hold one position and still tell people that they don't have to hold by me. And he says that there was a case in Israel where, it was an American woman, a Baalas Tshuva, who they called Israel. She was pregnant, and they saw that there was real problems, mum chamur ma'od, real problems with the fetus, and the woman wanted to have an abortion. So They called Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in Israel, and he answered that my opinion in this, that you cannot have an abortion. He was very strict about abortion, and there's no room to permit it. But then the doctor continued to ask, and he went through the whole story that this was a woman who was a Balas Tshuva, and it's a Shas Adchak, it's an emergency measure, etc., etc. Is there any way that we can be lenient here? And Rav Shlomo Zalman replied to him. He said, call him back. And when he called him back, Rav Shlomo Zalman said, tell the woman that there's a great posek in Jerusalem named Rabbi Waldenberg, and he holds that you can abort the fetus. And don't tell her that I disagree with this, because this woman is not one of my students. She doesn't have to listen to me. And if Rav Waldenberg says that you can do an abortion in that case, and the woman really wants to, and there's reason for it, Rav Shlomo Zalman was willing to say, even though I think it's us, sir, Rav Waldenberg thinks it's more to rely on him. We don't usually have poskim, I don't think at least, who act like this, but most, that was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Okay. Oh, very nice. Rav Schechter told the same to his son, to Rabbi Ira's son. Look, we know that there are many other rabbis who held this position. It's funny if talking, not just from Regensburg, many others. I think the chiddush here is that Rav Schechter telling us that Rav Soloveitchik's position, I think you have to call it a bit of rhetoric. He's really speaking to his students and telling them, this is what I think, but as not an, he's not saying that the other position is really wrong, or it's terrible, or you're doing a bad thing. He's saying that my position, but let me read you one more thing. Along these same lines, Rav Schechter quotes, he quotes one other example. When his sister was married, he says, his mother was still in mourning 12 months, and his father, this is his father was Rav Melech Schechter, a long time Rav, they asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, what can his mother do anything at the wedding? Because there were those who thought that if you, for 5 minutes, you act like a waiter and you pour some drinks, that all of a sudden you could stay at the wedding and be there the whole time. And Rav Soloveitchik was very opposed to this. And Rav Schechter quotes Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach also thought this is complete nonsense. So therefore, he gave that answer. And the students asked him, then, wait a second, they were there when someone else asked Rav Soloveitchik the exact same question, and Rav Soloveitchik said that you can rely on these rabbis who say that, you know, you can pour some drinks and then you could stay at the wedding. So he said, what's going on here? And Rav Soloveitchik answered as follows. He said, this other person who came to ask me, he wasn't one of my students, and he wasn't a Musmach of Yeshiva University, and he wasn't interested in knowing my opinion. Rather, he wanted to find a leniency. He wanted to see if there was room to permit him to go to the wedding, because this was family. And therefore, I told him that there are many rabbis who permit it, and he could rely on it. Remember, the person was coming to ask a question, is there a way that I can be permitted to go? But you, Rabbi Melech Schechter, you were asking because you wanted to know what my opinion was. And if I told you it's us, sir, you'd listen to me, and you wanted to follow what I said. You didn't want to find it if there was a leniency, you wanted to follow what I said. Therefore, I told him my opinion. So, this explains a lot. All these stories you have of Rav Soloveitchik saying different things to different people. Rav Soloveitchik knows there's a spectrum of views. If there's a situation that someone asks him and he knows a great posek holds of it, so he says, okay, that's, you can rely on that. But if it's one of his students or the person Dafka wants to follow Rav Soloveitchik holds, he'll give him a different answer. I think it's very interesting. Yeah, that was the time. Let's return to Rav Henkin now. Among other interesting sukkim of Rav Henkin, and stick to the women's issue for a minute. Rav Henkin said that a woman could say Kaddish. And this became very famous. Okay, big deal. A woman could say Kaddish. In most of the communities, the people listening, the modern Orthodox community, that's done all the time. Although we do have Haredi, people go to Haredi shuls, Haredim, maybe they don't see that. But he gave this ruling in 1947, when a woman's position in the synagogue was very different. It's not just a 1947 ruling. You can find this in Volume 2, pages 5 and 6. And his grandson, Rabbi Huda Hotzahenkin, elaborates this in great detail. But he goes on and he says that, first of all, you have this discussion. You have Acharonim who discuss whether a woman could say the Kaddish. And you even have leniency in earlier generations if it was in a house, like a private minyan, but not in a shul. And Rav Avadya Yosef, who affirmed this ruling just a couple weeks ago, Rav Henkin said that all these rulings are irrelevant anyway, because they're referring to a situation where you have one person say Kaddish for the community. So in that situation, okay, you can understand that in a synagogue, you don't want to have maybe just one woman, although we'll see that he disagrees with that anyway. But first of all, in our communities, everyone says Kaddish. So, of course, there should be no problem at all. But then he goes further, and he tells us a very interesting historical point. First of all, he says the woman, even if there's one woman, she should stay behind the mechitza. But if she comes in front of the mechitza, it's not so terrible. But he says, he speaks about the importance of going to synagogue and Kaddish. It brings people close to Judaism. He says, though, I remember when I was young, there was a young woman who said Kaddish in front of the men, the Kehillah Shel Chassidim V'Yoreim. So he tells us that in Europe, he recalls a woman saying Kaddish in front of the men. Maybe you don't want to believe it. It's his memory. He's forgetting something. Well, Rav Soloveitchik testified to the same thing. Rav Soloveitchik testified that he was asked by there used to be an organization called Yavna. It was an Orthodox student organization. It doesn't exist anymore. At the various big universities, he was asked about this question about women saying Kaddish. And first of all, he said it's permitted to do it, but he also said that he remembers before World War II in Vilna, in the koys of the Vilna Gaon, that the Vilna Gaon had a shul there. If you recall, I mentioned what happened when a baron from Montreal led a tour a couple of years ago to Vilna. He's a graduate of Baranovich, and lo and behold, when he saw that in the koys of the Vilna Gaon, in the shul, in the same place where the Vilna Gaon declared a cheirim on Chassidus, the sitter in that shul is now Tehillas Hashem, Rav Baron went crazy. he started screaming, so I've heard, you know, the greatest disgrace ever, that in the Vilna Gaon's own koys, if you recall what we just read in the Megillah, conquered in his own palace, The Chabad has moved into the Vilna Gaon's koys. But the Rav recalls in the Vilna Gaon's koys, let me read it to you, that a woman would come in and stand in the back and say Kaddish after Myriv. And this was obviously not a so-called modern Orthodox shul. And the person who wrote about this, Joel Walowski, quoted someone, one of the Gabayim from the Mir Minyan in Brooklyn, and he testified that in Vilna, when his cousin died and he didn't have sons, Rav Chaim Ozer Paskind, that his oldest daughter, his grown daughter, could say Kaddish every day in the Vilna Shul. And this rabbi from the Mir testified that she would come in every day to the synagogue and say Kaddish, as Rav Chaim Ozer said. And someone else said that his father learnt with the Chafetz Chaim, and the Chafetz Chaim said the same thing. And the rabbi Abai Tzagan, that was Rav Minahar, said that he heard before many years that women would come into shuls in Mea Sha'arim to say Kaddish. And many old people recalled that. And if you still don't want to accept it, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Yossi says it, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Orach Chaim, Volume 5, page 20. If you're looking on the Bar Ilan, this is number 12. He was asked a question, do you need a machitza? If you just have a few women. And he raises the question, let's say in a Shiva minion, things like that, do you need a machitza? He actually is a little strict in this, because he says if you have one woman or two women, you don't, but if you have more than that, you do need a machitza. And I've never seen this. Minhag Yisrael, I think, is that the woman will just stay in the back, and the assumption being that it's not a permanent thing. But okay, Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks he should. He's a little unsure, because the whole idea of machitza has to be clarified. But if it's just one or two women and it's a cry, you know, a temporary, he says you don't need a machitza. But then he says that, once again, B'chol Hador wrote, in all the generations, the practice was that occasionally a woman would come into the shul, the base medrash. These batei medrash in small towns did not have women's sections. They would come into this base medrash to get money. Oh, a veil or a mourner, a woman mourner, to say Kaddish. So she'd come into the shul to say Kaddish. So we have all this testimony that in Europe, women would say Kaddish. So it becomes a little bit hard to say that all of a sudden it's a problem for women to say Kaddish, especially when they're on the other side of the Mechitza. What could possibly be the problem? You're going to hear a woman's voice? So women would say Kaddish, say Birkas HaGomel. Okay, then they say, well, you weaken the traditions. You weaken the traditions, which is why the whole point of Rav Henkin and the others is that the tradition Dafka was that women would say Kaddish and would come in. So that's, I think, significant. Let's see, what do we have here? Yeah, he says mutter, it's not the minhag. You know, he doesn't want to permit it because it'll break with the minhag. If I'm not mistaken, the Chavos Yair says, though, in a private environment, you can. It's the Chavos Yair who says it, correct? Rav Hagen's point was that, in any event, when earlier people spoke about the Kaddish, it's the old practice of where one person would say Kaddish. Today, I don't know, does anyone go to a shul where one person says Kaddish, who's appointed to? You have all these disputes in the responsa literature. Who should be given the right to say Kaddish? Because if only one person's saying Kaddish, then it's a question. We don't have that issue because we all say Kaddish together. Robert, before we go on. I don't know. What does that mean? She wasn't allowed to say Kaddish. If she's on her side of the Mechitza, she starts saying Kaddish. Someone's going to tell her to be quiet? Very strange, anyway. We're not talking Asharim here. We're talking a religious Zionist community, certainly under the influence of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Can't imagine what would be the reason, but... it's still a custom, yes. It might still be the custom there. Let me... just a second here. I'll read you... Rav Henkin describes how the olden practice was the person saying Kaddish would go up in front of the teva, that is, right to the front of the synagogue, and he says it's not proper to allow a girl to go into the middle as if she's the shliach tzibur. But today, when everyone says it in their place, and many people say it at the same time, you don't have to reject this. And he says, Nachon shetamal acharei mechitza. It's proper that she stand behind mechitza, but if she happened to come in, and she didn't stand, it's not a terrible thing, because that's what they used to do in Europe. Okay. Another interesting thing he discusses, which has a lot of relevance to America, which is significant for American Jewish history, is he was asked about, can you use grape juice for Kiddush? Today, I can't imagine anyone saying there's a problem. We all use grape juice for Kiddush. In fact, if you have kids, the Kedem... gold grape juice is the greatest because you don't have to worry about all these stains. In fact, the real question is not just why we use Kedem, it's why can't we use Welch's? I mean, if I recall when I was young, they used to use it, apparently it's all mavushal. I don't know, someone needs to investigate it. But there was a historical reason why this was an issue. And Rav Henkin actually said it's forbidden. What's the issue? Well, during Prohibition, there's a whole article about this, a great article about Orthodox responses to Prohibition. Liquor, wine was illegal. There was an exemption for sacramental purposes, for the Catholic Church and for Jews to make Kiddush. The problem was, you think Chilul Hashem is only a recent phenomenon, although I tell you we have much more of it now than we used to, maybe because we have many more, but you had a lot of Chilul Hashem going on. You had rabbis and others who got government permission to prepare wine and to deal in wine for sacramental purposes, and instead they were selling it black market. They were selling it to all sorts of people. My grandmother remembers in Brownsville people who were bootlegging, who were taking the wine, and she remembers people going across the roof and coming down the fire escapes running away from the police. So that was a big business, and it created terrible Chilul Hashem because you had all these rabbis and others who were busted for illegal dealings. I mean, the Yetzer Hara, I guess, was too much. And as anyone is interested, the whole article by Chana Sprecher on this practice, seeing the Chilul Hashem, Louis Ginsberg. Professor Louis Ginsberg wrote a long response, 70 pages. I think it's on HebrewBooks.org. CYL, while we're talking, if you can check, let me know if Louis Ginsberg's response is on, did they spell the name with a tzadi or with a zion? I'm not sure. But if you can't find it, look under Hirushim v'Chidushim Birshama, you'll find it. I think it's on HebrewBooks.org. Again, until someone tells them that this is the conservative figure. So Louis Ginsberg comes out with this responsum, which then, of course, becomes important for the conservative movement, that there's nothing wrong with using grape juice. So the Orthodox, then, need to respond to this. And you have Orthodox rabbis, therefore, saying that it's absolutely forbidden. Rabbi Hurwitz from Hartford, who's famous for writing about how women don't need to cover their hair anymore today, he was a big rav. Rav Soloveitchik actually had a lot of respect for him. Thought he was one of the biggest rabbanim in America. He wrote we've discussed this book, Yad HaLevi, on Sefer HaMitzvos. While he's lenient in one section about women covering their hair, when he deals with the grape juice, not only is he very strict, he refers to Ginsberg as the Gaon of the Karaites, and just blasts him and tears him apart. Rav Henkin also assumes that the grape juice is forbidden. I think that most of these rabbis who are saying it's forbidden to use grape juice, and most of them were saying it was forbidden, I think there's a lot of polemics going on here that they couldn't look at it objectively. If the conservative movements had declared that it's not just permitted, it's something you should do, they were immediately inclined to say otherwise. And we've seen this over and over again with the Bat Mitzvah celebration, with the prenuptial agreements. The Orthodox rabbis often immediately say something's forbidden because the conservatives permitted it. Although Rav Henk, and this might be subconscious, not actually consciously, but Rav Henkin does give reasons why it should be forbidden. He says that you can't get drunk from wine, and in order for it to be valid for Kiddush, from grape juice, and in order for it to be valid for Kiddush, it has to be something you can get drunk over, and that applies also for the four cups. So he gives reasons, but again, I wonder if in the back of his mind, even unconsciously, is the fact that the conservative movement is pushing grape juice, and therefore this leads him to push wine. In volume 2, page 29, Rav Henkin, and I believe he's the first, permits use of a Shabbos elevator. The very first one, I think, to ever permit it. The very next page, page 30, volume 2, is something amazing. He seems to permit using an umbrella on Shabbos. Why do I say he seems to permit it? Because he was asked, can you use an umbrella? And he says, on the one hand, there's a reason to permit it if it's already open from before Shabbos. And on the other hand, the Aruch HaShulchan forbids it, and also the Nota B'Yehuda. And then he says, V'amnam, but the Tiferes Yisrael permits it. So he doesn't say it's forbidden, that's for sure. And he seems to leave open the option, do what you want. Why do I think this is significant? Because he was saying this, 50, 60 years ago. Today, no one would permit using an umbrella for Shabbos. And the question, of course, is why not? Well, what's really the problem? The Chassam Sofer, he's writing in Pressburg in the early 19th century. Not only does he permit it, he says that most Jews in Pressburg carry an umbrella on Shabbos. But today, no one, not even the followers of the Chassam Sofer, carry an umbrella on Shabbos. And I said, it's not so easy to explain. After all, we have baked carriages, and we open no one says there's a problem to open the umbrella on the baby carriage when the reason I mention a baby carriage is because if you have like one of these umbrellas in the ground or like with you're on your deck over your table, that's already stationary, so there's enough of a heter for that. But it would seem that the baby carriage is a portable tent, if you can open it up and close it. And if we permit it for the baby carriage, why not permit it for an umbrella? And certainly if it's already open, so there's reasons to permit it, but no one will. It's already become the Minhag Yisrael. No one would dare to. Rabbi Rakefet, in one of his tapes, says that you should ask Rabbi Avad Yosef, because the only person who has enough strength and would be willing to go against the unanimous practice would be Rav Avadya Yosef. And he could very easily look at the Chasam Sofer and others, so the Notabi who disagrees. But the Chasam Sofer is the Chasam Sofer. This used to be the Minhag. Some would say the Chasam Sofer, you can open it, but certainly if it's already open before Shabbos, not a problem. But Rabbi Rekevet didn't need to say that, because in Yechav Adas, Volume 4, Rav Avadya Yosef was asked about this, and he ruled that it's forbidden. You can't use it. I find things like this so significant. Those who've been listening to these lectures for some time probably picked up on this, that I'm very interested in changes in Orthodox practice, how things that used to be permitted then become forbidden, and how things that used to become forbidden then became permitted, because the great fiction, the great myth of Orthodox Judaism is that Orthodox Judaism is about continuation with the past. It's about tradition. And in fact, Orthodox Judaism is very much a dynamic movement, a movement that changes and undergoes all sorts of variations and really reconstructions. To use Chaim Soloveitchik's term, rupture and reconstruction. Since I just mentioned the Chasam Sofer, do you know that every person in the world today, including the followers of the Chasam Sofer, the people who live in this group that's called Chug Chasam Sofer, everyone ends Shabbos later than the Chasam Sofer, than was ended in Pressburg? That's incredible. And not only that, not only does everyone in the world today end Shabbos later, and Shabbos was ended in Pressburg. The Chasam Sofer says 35 minutes after sunset. But I'll tell you even more. Everyone today starts Shabbos earlier than what was done in almost every Jewish community throughout history. Until World War II, many Jewish communities started Shabbos after sunset. In the days of the Shulchan Aruch, almost all communities started Shabbos after sunset. Up until World War I, in certain parts of Europe, it was standard to start Shabbos after sunset, 15 minutes even after sunset. What we think, this is in accordance with Rabbeinu Tam. When we think about Rabbeinu Tam's view, everyone just thinks in terms of when Shabbos ends, 72 minutes after sunset. But Rabbeinu Tam also had a different position, when Shabbos begins. And it begins later than we begin it. I don't know. We have lots of learned people online. Maybe some of you could tell me, is there any community in the world today that starts Shabbos after sunset? I asked someone from a Hungarian Hasidic community in the Spring Valley, and he says that some people do it privately to keep the minhag going. But no one publicly will do it, and is not so long ago, in the 1950s, you still had Hungarian Hasidim in Brooklyn who were starting Shabbos, who were doing malacha after sunset, and I know this because I have a placard condemning them. So you see how, I'm going to discuss this in my new book, dealing with censorship, because this... Why is this related to censorship? Because the Chasam Sofer's novelet, his Chidushim, which describes when Shabbos ended in Pressburg, they censored it. So I wanted to talk about the whole issue, but I find this incredibly important. Shabbos is, what's more important than Shabbos? And the fact that the times of starting Shabbos and ending Shabbos have changed within the last 50, 60 years. There's been major changes. And we're not talking about little things here. Literally, the times when you start and end Shabbos have changed. That, to me, shows how dynamic Orthodoxy is more than anything. If you're asking me where the calendars get their times from, I have no idea where they get the times from. When I grew up, it was always 45 minutes after sunset. That was the 45 minutes, so that was always like an hour and 2 or 3 minutes after Shabbos started, as after the 18 minutes before sunset. Today, that was when I grew up in my town, West Orange. I moved back to my town, West Orange, about 8 years ago, and it's no one, they've moved it up, added a few more minutes to it. But I don't know who makes up these times and where they get it. And truthfully, the time should be different, depending if you're up in Alaska or in Maine versus other places. That is how many minutes after sunset. He's not on with us tonight, but Bill Gewertz, who's been on the last few weeks, is an expert in this area, and on the Svarim blog, he's putting portions of his forthcoming book on the topic of the Zmanim, of the times. There's a website, On the Main Line, it's called, and he has posted there calendars from America and from Canada from like 200 years ago, in which they tell you when Shabbos starts. Remember, they didn't have clocks like we have, exact time in those days. They couldn't tell you exactly when sunset was. They didn't have naval observatories doing these things. And it's very interesting to see how It's like 1 week, it's 5 minutes after the next week. They do it in intervals of 5 minutes. So it's not meant to be exact anyway, but the fact, as I said, that Shabbos is celebrated differently in the year 2010 than it was celebrated in the year 1910. And some of you might not believe me when I'm telling you, but and if you don't want to take my word for it, I will send you the information. I'll put it up on the screen next time. And as I said, the Chasam Sofer speaks about carrying umbrellas. Pretty much everyone did that in Hungary. Rav Henkin leaves it as an issue. He quotes both sides, doesn't say it's forbidden. And today, not only is it forbidden, but I don't think there's a posik in the world who would be able to say it's permitted. It's become so basic, the Shabbos observance, that I think you'd be considered a Zakei Mamre if you broke with that. I don't even think a Rav Moshe Feinstein could perhaps break with that. Well, I don't know. Rabbis don't make the charts. In other words, someone's making these charts. I don't know. Can someone find out? When you go online, like the Chabad site, or you look at the various calendars, the Ezra's Torah, the others, where they tell you what the times are for every city, maybe it's 18 minutes before sunset. Sunset we can determine. And when Shabbos ends, though, that's where it really gets tricky, because different times of the year and different parts of the globe, it could be dark. You could have 3 stars out there in 30 minutes. In other places, 16 minutes pass, and it still looks pretty light. So this idea that we can just do it as we do today automatically, that's problematic for a variety of reasons. So I don't know. If someone can figure out where they get these charts from. But these charts are there's been a lot of randomness about this throughout the generations. The Munkach Rav speaks about how in Pressburg they end Shabbos too early. And he says anyone can go to Pressburg and you can see in the summer months they're ending it and look outside and it's not dark yet. I mean the whole idea of Rabbeinu Tam and the Gaonim, their different views, he's created a lot of problems because people looked outside. Rabbeinu Tam looks outside, he's in France, and he sees one thing. And in the land of Israel, you see something else entirely. Certainly the Rishonim didn't understand what was going on in different parts of the globe. It's a very complicated topic from my point of view. I'm not an expert in that, and I don't understand all the astronomy that people like Bill Gewirtz deal with. I'm more interested in on the ground, in the practice, how Shabbos was celebrated differently in different times. We celebrate it now in accordance with the Gaonic position. Rabbeinu Tam's position was the mainstream position all over Europe, even until World War II, certainly until World War I. There's a book called Hazmanim B'Halacha that has all sorts of charts in which he breaks it down, in which parts, in Poland, for example, they often held by Rabbeinu, by the Gaonim, but in other places they held by Rabbeinu Tam. Let's go further. Very relevant. We're coming up to Pesach. Rav Henkin was asked about using kitnios derivatives. We've discussed this over and over again. You go to your supermarket, you'll see the Joyva marshmallows, those nice chocolate-covered marshmallows, which used to have gelatin. Another topic we'll get to, either if not today, next class. Now it says fish gelatin. But they have kitnios derivatives, corn syrup, and in big writing on the side, it says that this product contains corn syrup. Kitnios derivatives are permitted in accordance with the Pesach of the Posek Ador, Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. And many others also agreed with that, including Rav Henkin. And Rav Henkin says this is certainly the case with regard to peanut oil. And he cites Rabbi Graubart from Toronto, who we've spoken about Rabbi Graubart in the past. I've mentioned Rav Moshe Feinstein's position that if you don't have a minhag, not to have peanuts, then there's no minhag for you. But today, because the hashkacha companies don't give hashkacha to anything with peanuts, pretty much everyone has been given the minhag not to have peanuts. So if you want to break that, you can, I guess, distribute peanuts to your family this year at the Seder, just so they know that it's not your minhag not to have peanuts. In Lithuania, people ate peanuts on Pesach, but Rabbi Graubart, independently of Rav Kook, comes to the same conclusion. If you recall what I told you about Rav Kook, Rav Kook says that by definition, kitnios cannot be more strict than chametz. What is chametz? Chametz is when it comes into contact with liquid. And therefore, if you want to pick up a piece of grain and just start eating it, that's not a problem. Therefore, by definition, kitnios cannot be more stringent. There is no problem there for eating, let's say, dry string beans or eating peanuts, because if they haven't been come into contact with any liquid and been processed in the food, if it wouldn't be usher if it was chametz, how can it be usher when it's kitnios? And Rav Hanging gives, that's his position. Then he goes on, a few pages later, and he is asked and deals with a question that really was very relevant in his day. In the 1940s, 1950s, the OU really starts to get going. Hashkachas on packaged foods. Until then, obviously you had hashkachas. You had hashkachas on butchers and on shochting. But you didn't have hashkachas on products. There wasn't such a market. Companies were not interested in it. How did you determine if it was kosher? Well, there's a few different ways to determine. First of all, rabbis would investigate. They'd contact the companies. They'd write letters to them, and they'd find out. The big issue then was animal shortening. If we all can recall maybe our youth, Nabisco never could get a hashkacha because it always had animal shortening. Today, I don't know of any products that have animal shortening. It's not as healthy. And Rav Moshe Feinstein has a response to them in which he says that if the company tells you there's no animal shortening, you can rely on it. Today, we're living in an almost like a Gan Eden here. You go into a supermarket, any supermarket in the country, and foods that don't have cheese and don't have meat, it seems to me at least, that probably 75% have some hashkacha, one hashkacha or another. The amount of, it's enormous. But try to imagine yourself in an era where none of the packaged foods have hashkachas. Well, you don't need to imagine it. Go to Europe. In Europe today, they don't have a big enough Jewish population that in almost all countries, I don't know about France, but all the other countries, this includes England as well, you don't have hashkachas on products. So what do you do? How to live as a Jew? Now, we've been brought up, and it's become part of our slang, that if you have a product that doesn't have hashkacha on it, people will say it's not kosher. Like they'll say, this product isn't kosher. Or you can't eat it, it's not kosher. When really what we mean is that we don't know if it's kosher. It doesn't have hashkacha on it. But the fact that it doesn't have hashkacha doesn't necessarily mean it's not kosher. But that's what we've become accustomed to. So what about in an era when you didn't have any hashkachas? Okay, so the first thing is, as I said, the rabbi would investigate, and then they'd come out with lists. And they'd tell the congregants, and everyone would know that this you can eat. Also, ingredient labels. It became popular and accepted to trust the ingredient labels, because you had an FDA, I don't know when the FDA was established, but before that you had other organizations, governmental watchdogs. And there's an assumption that in halacha that a person is not going to do something that if it's found out will destroy his business. So that there was a principle that was accepted that ingredients, that certain products, you know that really nothing could go in it, and if the ingredients don't have anything out of the ordinary, because also there's another principle in halacha that a merchant is going to do what's cheapest for him and what makes most sense. And if you have a non-kosher item and a kosher item, and he tells you what's in it, and the non-kosher item will be much more expensive, there's no reason in the world we have to assume or suspect that he's going to put the non-kosher item. If the non-kosher item's cheaper and than the kosher item, and he tells you the kosher item's in it, then there's a problem, because he might take the non-kosher item. However, even in that circumstance, if you have governmental regulations, and there could be big fines or lawsuits, that gives reason even to trust it in such a case. Okay, so that's how people lived. People kept kosher 50 years ago. Before there was, not only that, the OU, when the OU first started getting going, many of the real from, the Agudas Rabbanim, said the OU is not reliable. Can't trust them. Because what was the OU? They said the OU is an organization, half of its shuls are non-machitza shuls, and we're going to trust these rabbis and this organization, any organization that allows shuls in it that don't have machitzas is not a reliable organization. Obviously, the OU is very different today. It's no accident that in addition to a Rav Schechter, you have a Rabbi Belsky. It's very important for the OU to have a Haredi poseg there, because for their hashkacha to be accepted in the right-wing world, they need to have a right-wing poseg. Now, they can't just have the right-wing poseg without having also the more modern poseg, because then that'll really create a problem. The OU is supposed to be a so-called modern Orthodox organization. Now, so Rav Hanking discusses this issue. Now, you know, do we need, what's the point of the hashkachas? That's what he discusses. After all, if we have these principles of halacha, that the companies, there's achrayos, there's government responsibility, and they have to tell us what's in it. Do we need these hashgachas? Why do we need them? And can you ignore it and just buy any food you want? I will pick up. I see it's already 10 o'clock. What we're going to do next time is, first of all, I'm going to pick up with the hashgachas, what Rav Henkin says. I will talk a little bit about the European situation. I think you'll find that interesting. And then just a few more things about Rav Henkin. And I think next class we will begin looking at not just a very interesting and... let me pull up the screen here. Not just a very interesting halachist, Rav Eliezer Berkovitz, but also a theologian. We've spoken about some theologians, and he will take us really to the end of the semester, maybe even to next semester. I think some of you maybe are his students. There's a lot more to say. I will hold off on probably another half hour with Rav Henkin. Do we have any questions here? I'm going to turn up the light a bit. CYL, I see, is typing. We'll see if he checked up for me on the Louis Ginsberg responsum. You couldn't find it. Okay, so it might not be there. It's called a responsum on grape juice or something like that. It was also reprinted recently. Rabbi David Lincoln, the conservative rabbi, reprinted all of Ginsberg's responsa. In fact, I'll deal with this a bit next week because, ironically, Ginsberg comes out lachumra on gelatin, unlike Rav Henkin and Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. And in there, he reprinted it. But as I said, you can find Ginsberg's four-volume commentary on the Jerusalem Talmud on HebrewBooks.org. He spoke English. He came to America. When did he come? I forget the year I said he came, 1922 or something. So he certainly spoke English. How well? Rav Moshe Feinstein spoke English. How well he spoke English, I don't know. Rav Moshe used to read the New York Times, although his son told me that he wouldn't answer a question in English because he wanted to be sure he understood it. It's a good question. I don't know. You didn't really have such kanaim. The only kanaim you had were really the Neturei Karta and the Satmar ones, and they thought that he was Modernish, but they thought Rav Moshe Feinstein was Modernish. Rabbi Baruch Oberlander, the Chabad Rav of Hungary, of Budapest, who then turned Chabad, and he grew up as Hungarian, a Papa Chassid, who became Chabad, he told me that growing up, they assumed that Rav Moshe Feinstein was just a rabbi for the Posek for the Modern Orthodox. You know, they saw him as Modernish. People in Lakewood, they didn't hold of Rav Moshe. They didn't hold of Rav Henkin either, a lot of his psukim. They used to say something about Rav Moshe Feinstein. I forget the joke they used to say. But you really didn't have. How many kanaim did you have? You had maybe a few in Lakewood and a few in Tells, but you didn't have kanaim. It wasn't like today. Kanaim were, you had some Hungarian Hasidim, but the phenomenon of Kanais really gets going in the 1970s, and by then Rav Henkin wasn't alive. Who was the Kanaim? You had the Satmar, but these are not even part of our community. When I speak about Kanaim, I talk about Lithuanian Kanaim. That was, really wasn't a phenomenon yet. Chaim Blach, yes. Chaim Blach, I'm not going to get into him now, Chaim, just to tell you, though, that in Chaim Bach's early writings, he praises Rav Henkin as a great tzaddik. In his later writings, that's when he attacks him. But in my next Sfarim blog post, which I think will be out in the next 2 weeks, I give all the references to that. So he says he permits pigs. That's what he said, Chaim Bach. Chaim Bach, if he said it, has nothing to do with kanais, being a kanai. Rav Henkin ruled against Chaim Bach in the Din Torah. So all of a sudden, he was out to get him. Chaim Bach was anything but a kanai. It, in the conservative prayer books in Ritzei Vechleitzein of Yom HaShavuot, Ishei, where it says Ishei, the burnt offerings, since they don't, in the old Silverman, I think it's called the Silverman Prayer Book, since they don't look forward to a resumption of sacrifices, v'yishei Yisrael, v'tfilatam, they take out yishei Yisrael, the sacrifices. That, as far as I know, that was the only change in the old conservative Siddur, not the Siddur Sim Shalom. When the Siddur Sim Shalom came out, David Feldman and some other conservative rabbis said that it's forbidden to daven with that Siddur. You're not to fulfill the mitzvah of davening from that Siddur. But the old conservative Siddur, the service Siddur, they just took out Yishei Yisrael. As far as I know, that was the only thing. I don't think anyone davens with that Siddur anymore. Okay, Rabbi Ira's typing. Okay, I guess not. Rabbi Ira started typing and then disappeared. Oh, here he is. Not even Yishei Yisrael? Look, maybe not. Okay. The old conservative prayer book, look, in the typical conservative synagogue, they had the Herz Chumash. That was their Chumash. And in many, many conservative synagogues, they had the Birnbaum Siddur. I recall going to Cousins Bar Mitzvahs 35 years ago, and they had the Birnbaum Siddur there. Then, of course, you have the... A few years ago, you have the new conservative Chumash, the Eitz Chaim, and also the conservative prayer book. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, that would make sense. If they didn't take it out entirely, to see it as something in the past, you look to. Okay, very good. Incrementally. Okay, well, thank you for that. Okay, do we have anything else? I'll wait one more minute. Good question. I don't know. Well, he shouldn't have worn a Rosh Hashiva style hat because he wasn't a Rosh Hashiva. I can't say. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik did not wear traditional rabbinic garb. Zipha Zelig didn't. Rabbi J.B. Soloveitchik didn't. You had many rabbis who didn't, but I don't know... I don't even know what there wasn't the unanimously style of a Rosh Hashiva style hat. Some wore, more of like the top hat. They wore different style hats. What they seem to all have worn, and I've been trying to get this, if anyone knows where I can buy it, is the old Lithuanian kippah, the kapel, is that thing that goes up like that. You see the pictures of Rabbi Unterman or Rav Moshe Feinstein. That seems to be the yarmulke that most of them wear. I don't know if Rav Henkin wore that. Let me see if he has that. You can't see in this. Well, there's his hat, so you see. It does look like a traditional hat. But if anyone knows where I can get to one of those old Lithuanian, David Lishitz used to wear it, the sort of one that stands up on your head. I've looked in all sorts of stores in Brooklyn. I can't find the old Lithuanian yarmulke. So a place in Berlin that sells them. Okay, well, if you can find a place in Berlin, I'd be very happy to get it. Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone. I look forward to seeing you next week. Next week is the sixth class, so there's three more. And as I said, we should move into Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz's next class. Well, if it's the same, I don't know if it's the same, but where do the Chazanim get it? I don't know. If you know, please let me know. I'd like to get it for myself. At least for Purim, it would be nice to wear. Okay, good night, everyone.